Okay. So as I said, I will be following a handout, and the better copies are in the packet that I distributed on the first day. And as I also said, it's about one dimension up, but even before that, I want to tell you about the bigger picture. So this is a handout that it should be impossible to read, and I don't really expect you to read it. But I made it for a different talk in which I tried to put everything in 1 hour. And of course, it was in very little detail. And I just want to go through the structure of this handout. So really, it's a 3x4 grid, and the rows are labeled topology, combinatorics, low algebra, and high algebra. The labels are here, and I'm sure you can all read them. Maybe with good eyes you can read them on the actual printouts. And the columns are kind of crooked, but anyway, the first column is labeled U-naughts. The second column is labeled V-naughts. It's this box, that box. And the last column is labeled W-naughts. This one, this one, this one, this one. And the point is that I was talking about three alternative theories, or not alternative, but three different knot theories. And each one has a topology, combinatorics, low algebra, and high algebra. And so far, all we talked about was the U column. And in fact, the U column also has a quantum field theory related to it, and several other aspects, okay? But so the topology was knot theory, the combinatorics was the combinatorics of core diagrams, like we talked about before. The low algebra was the relationship with the universal enveloping algebra. Actually, you cannot read it, but it's on your handout. And the high algebra was, maybe you can recognize it, this was the thing that led to the Pentagon equation. And then the claim is that there are parallel stories for V-naughts and for W-naughts, and today I'm going to talk about W-naughts. And it will start with two-dimensional knot in R form and end in a statement about sort of the high algebra statement is a statement about convolution algebras on Lie algebras and their corresponding Lie groups. Okay? And the column I will miss will be the V-naught column, which is in the middle. And I will miss it, so I'll say nothing about it. But let me add another thing. So it turns out that there are another thing that, which I will not really talk about today, but there are maps between these columns. So basically, if you have an ordinary knot in R3, there is some canonical way of so-called spinning it so as to get a two-dimensional knot in R4. And this map sort of induces maps between all in all rows. So at the end, it turns out that solving this Kashiwara-Verne problem about convolutions is related to associators. And the easiest way to see this relationship is by realizing that it comes from spinning three-dimensional knots so as to turn them into four-dimensional. But this is, again, sort of what I'm not going to talk about. It's about the bigger picture. Now just the bigger picture of today's talk. So first of all, I will introduce, unfortunately, this handout was prepared for a different lecture that I gave in Bonn a year ago, or more than a year ago. And I was going through it in a different order. My rationale was different, so many things here are backwards. So today's talk will go from the bottom to the top. And I'll start with a non-theoretic statement. But the non-theoretic statement, first of all, I have to introduce the corresponding knot theory. Then I'll introduce the general machinery of turning knot theories into statements. And then I'll have a non-theoretic statement. And then I'll go through a sequence of equivalences where it's morally equivalent, or in fact equivalent to a diagrammatic statement, which is morally equivalent to an algebraic statement, which is essentially equivalent to a statement about unitary operators, which is essentially equivalent to a statement about group algebras of, well, or universal enveloping algebras. Again, you'll see when I get to it. And which is essentially equivalent to this convolution statement. So that's sort of the overall scheme, but I'll start with knot theory. Okay, here's the knot theory. So I will be talking about ribbon two knots in R4. I'll say the definition quickly, but you're not really, this is not somehow the key point. The key point is I'll show you what these knots really are. Okay? So a two knot is a surface, so it's a two-dimensional thing embedded in R4, except it's not any surface. I put a condition, and the condition is that the surface should bound a handle body. So basically, if the surface is a torus, it should bound a solid torus. Now, so that the solid torus would be allowed to have singularities, but only a restricted kind of singularities. And these singularities are so-called ribbon singularities, and they're defined over here, and I don't want to define them for you. Instead, let me show you sort of a few pictures. So maybe the first way of visualizing this is in the following way. So instead of drawing, you know, I cannot, maybe I should say that, you know, I cannot draw in R4. So what, or nobody can. So what people do instead is they look at various projections to R3 and then project them further to the plane. Okay? And there are many different ways to do it, so there are many different ways to view the same object. And part of the fun for today should be just to look at these different ways of viewing those objects in R4. So here's the first one. Okay? So if you have a ribbon in R3, same kind of ribbons that I was talking about before. Okay? So basically a small band embedded in R3. Here is a very small piece of it. It could be long, it could be knotted. Okay, there is a standard way to turn it into a tube in R4. And the standard way is, well, you take this ribbon, you double it, you make it out of two parallel membranes, and then you push one membrane up in R4, so in the T dimension, and then another the other membrane down in the T dimension, and glue them along the edges. So you get kind of a ribbon, except the picture is a bit misleading because really the ribbon sort of pops up in the R4 dimension and goes down in the R4 dimension. Okay? So with this way of representing tubes in R4, this tube fully this sort of pair of ribbons represents a non-singular pair of tubes in R4. Why? Because basically the outer, let me call the one that cuts through, so this one, let me call it the thinner one. Maybe when I made the picture I should have made it thinner. Okay? Had it been thinner, when you pop it out, it would pop out less than the thicker one. So therefore, I mean, even though in R3 they intersect, in R4 they actually don't, because this one pops out more than that one would. Okay? However, this is not a legitimate, this does not represent an honest knot in R4, because again, if I pop out both of these, then in the projection to R3, there will be an intersection along this line, but by the intermediate value theorem, if you think about it, sort of along the left-hand side, the slash on the left is maximally popped, and the backslash on the left is not popped at all. And when you go to the other end of this intersection line, it's the opposite, so by the intermediate value theorem, at some point they would have to meet in R4. Okay, so that's not a legitimate singularity. Okay? Now, another distinction between this knot theory and the standard knot theory in R3 is that in R4, these two pictures are the same. Because, in fact, in R4, line objects cannot be knotted or have no meaningful knot theory. Right? If you have two lines in, or strands in R4, well, in R3, in order to cross them, they would have to go through each other. Okay? But in R4, you can take a unit vector in, well, I'm not quite sure how to best demonstrate it, but they're not knotted. I don't know what to say. I mean, you can pass them through when they want to, when they want them, instead of going singular, you'll put this one to go a little bit at a different time, okay, or at a different R4 coordinate, then you let them cross, and they've crossed without singularity. So if the two bands are sufficiently narrow, you could have done it with bands, and therefore this is equal to that in R4. So these are a few points to note about R4 knot theory. Here are a few more pictures of the same thing. So first of all, the loveliest thing, which I will just call the crossing. So the symbolic notation for it is a crossing. But it's a crossing in which one of the components in above is above the other, but what it really means is that the other one cuts through it. It does not mean over in R4, it means through in some sense, okay? But it's nevertheless the same symbol as the symbol that I use in R3. And so in the notation I used before, it's this picture. Here is a different notation. So this, in this notation, you project the tubes to R3. You still see tubes. But when they need to go up in R4, sorry, down in R4, you make a cut. Kind of, you stop seeing them. So the thinner tube goes down in R4 so that it could cross the wall of the thicker tube. And then in order to come out of the thicker tube, it doesn't come out the same way. It comes out by pushing an annulus on the thicker tube down in R4 so as to make room for the blue one to pass through. So that's a different projection of the same picture. And finally, perhaps the prettiest projection, the prettiest way of thinking about it is the following. So you think of R4 as made of three space coordinates and time, and then a surface in R4 is a movie of one-dimensional things in R3. One-dimensional things are simply circles, okay? So a movie of circles in R3 is, well, the circles are flying around. So it's really a movie of flying rings, okay? And if two flying rings want to change places, they can do it in two ways. The way shown here, which I'll go back to it later, and it's just change places. And the lovelier way, which is one can fly through the other. I'm looking for the competent juggler that would be able to do it. So I've never found one yet. It's not me, okay? So the crossing represents two flying rings which interchange places by flying through each other. And the crossing has senses. There is an upper and a lower. Okay? I mean, either this one flies through that, or, well, I mean, it's topological, so that one could fly through that, even though it's bigger. Okay? Okay, but there is another kind of crossing. The 2D symbol for it would be a crossing in which the sense is not indicated. The band description is the band description I've shown before, but here the sense does not matter. Over is the same as under. The tube picture is two tubes passing next to each other without talking, and the flying rings picture is two flying rings, well, interchange places, and again, it doesn't matter if they interchange places this way, or that way, or that way, because all of these ways are homotopic. Okay. Now, actually, more stuff can happen in R4, and the stuff that I will, you see, really this talk should be given in two passes. So our first pass is not detailed, and second pass is detailed. And the stuff for the second pass I'll do in green. It's written in green. So I will kind of just indicate that green stuff exists, and so there is more than just the things I've indicated, but without detail. So, you know, in a flying ring could fly, and as it flies, it could shrink, right? Until it becomes a point and it disappears, and this is the cap. And the symbolic notation will be a line. A line that ends with a, I don't know, a dot, a bullet at the end. There is a fun thing that doesn't happen in R3, and it's called the when. The when is a piece of a Klein bottle. And again, since I'm not going to use it, I will not say much more about it. But it's there, and it's actually needed for this, for everything to work. Okay? And then, just like in R3, I will later need to switch to knotted graphs as opposed to knotted, just simple knots, okay? So I will need to introduce vertices, and the band description of a vertex is here, the tube description of a vertex is here, and really what a vertex is the following. So you think of a ring flying around in R3, and then all of a sudden, it splits into two. Okay? This is, by the way, a singular vertex. The split into two is a singular event. There is a different type of vertex, which I will not need, which is the pair of pants sort of picture, which, and you're welcome to try to visualize it in as a movie of flying rings. It's a different picture. It's not a single ring flying around and splitting, or maybe I'll reveal it. It's a single ring flying around and then eventually self-touching and then branching off into two rings. But anyway, this I will not mean. So I guess all I'm saying is that there is sort of a little dictionary of or a little small zoo of things, in fact of generators. And each of these generators has a planar symbol, a crossing or a senseless crossing, a crossing without a sense, or a point, a line that ends, or just a mark, W for when, or a vertex. And if you assemble these together, you can get bigger and bigger surfaces which are knotted in R4. Now, but you see, whenever you have generators, you have relations. So what are the relations that these symbols satisfy? Okay? So one relation is the standard, or one set of relations is the standard set of Rademeister moves, Rademeister 2, 3, and 4. 4 maybe I will come to later, but Rademeister 2 and 3. So Rademeister 2 is this picture, which in the language of flying rings means that if a ring flies into another one, changes its mind and flies out, that's equivalent to both of them never having flown. And it's obvious topologically, right? I mean, you can homotop this movie by sort of going in less and less to the movie in which nothing moves. Okay? There's also a Rademeister 3 picture. So the Rademeister 3 move is the move that says that this is equal to, I never get it right, to this, okay? And in the language of flying rings, you have three rings, a big, small, medium, okay? And I guess I need a volunteer. Would you? So really, the picture is, so just hold the big one steady. The big one, I suppose, is the uppermost. And then these two could fly one through, and then the other through, and then they could interchange places by flying one through the other. Or they could interchange places, and then one flies through, and then the other flies through. And it's clearly equivalent, because you could kind of move the point of interchange through the big ring. Okay? No, you're not that. There is also a similar thing for the senseless crossings. So if I kind of do the senseless Rademeister move, then, you know, sort of I have three rings, they want to interchange places, this one changes with that, this one changes with that, they do it externally, it's clear that the ordinary Rademeister relation still holds. Not that. So these are the so-called virtual Rademeister moves. There is a certain mixed Rademeister moves which I don't want to indicate, but then there is a fun move, and this is the overcrossings commute. The overcrossings commute says the following. If you have a senseless crossing and a thing going over it, so it first goes over the backslash and then it goes over the slash, it's the same as if it first goes over the slash and then over the backslash. Proof, so the over is the biggest, so it's the one you're holding. And then, what did I want to do? Okay, so this goes through, and then they exchange places externally. Not like before internally, they exchange places externally, okay? And that's the same as exchanging places externally and then going through. Okay, so that's the overcrossings commute. However, there is no undercrossing commute. The opposite relation in which you flip these sort of honest crossings to be down crossings, undercrossings, does not hold. And the picture for this is I should have two large things, and I want to go over one and then over the other, and it's not the same as going through this one and then through that one. Okay? And if you want the band, okay, so now I'm done. Thank you. So, if you want the band picture, it's this. Okay, so this is overcrossings commute, and it's visually obviously true. And this is undercrossings commute, or what would be undercrossing commute. And if you try to push the understrand kind of above the non-crossing, you clearly see that it comes out like sort of twisted. Okay? Likewise for the green stuff, which I will not do because it's sort of a one-pass version of this talk, for the green pass there are also distinctions. Okay? So, like, you can slide stuff over a bullet, but not under a bullet. And when you slide stuff over a when, it comes out unchanged, but when you slide stuff under a when, it comes out twisted in some way. Okay? Now, I should say that the statement that these relations are a complete description of two-dimensional ribbon knots in R4 has a slightly weird status. So Blake Winter, so this is the analog of the statement of Rademeister, that Rademeister moves described knots in R3. So, but anyway, Blake Winter proved it in the case of knotted circles, knotted tubes, okay? But the full generalization to arbitrary surfaces, I think, is believed, but was never written up. Okay? So, now I should say more, just like in the case of knots in R3, in the case of knots in R3, we had various operations, and the most important ones were the unzip operations. And there are likewise unzip operations in this picture. So, but in fact there are two. There is an unzip along an annulus, and there is an unzip along a disk. And again, I will not go through them. You see, it's in green. I don't need them or in one pass. So I can do it rather quickly. But the point is that if you have two trivalent vertices and a band in between them, that really represents an annulus in R3. If you have an annulus, in R4. If you have an annulus, you can replace it by two parallel ones, okay, sitting one inside the other if you want, even though inside doesn't really make sense in R4. But, you know, you could draw them inside, one inside the other when you project it to R3. And then the result is a picture like this, which is topologically the same as just two straight lines, okay? Likewise, if you have a trivalent vertex, which is then capped, then the thing above the singularity is really a disk, which you can replace by two parallel disks, and that's the same as capping the two legs independently. So there are various operations that can be performed on such ribbon trivalent vertices, ribbon trivalent surfaces, or in R3. Anyway, okay, having said that there is no sort of definite Rademeister theory for this picture, let me, instead of working with the four-dimensional objects, simply work with their planar representations. So, just like you could say that the space of knots and links is the space of, is the planar algebra generated by a single symbol. So, when you say a planar algebra, it has a formal definition, but really what it means is that you can put things side by side in the plane. So there is a certain multiplication operation, or in fact a set of multiplication operations, but they're not sort of along a line, but rather in a plane. You can multiply by putting things next to each other in a plane. So it's the planar algebra generated by a crossing modulo these relations. In fact, it's only the zero leg part of this planar algebra, because in the planar algebra there will be all sorts of gadgets like this one, which are incomplete constructions. This is the partial picture of the knot. You've kind of multiplied enough crossings, but not enough to close it up. So if you really wanted to talk about knots and links, it would be the planar algebra generated by one generator, modulo three relations, the zero legs part. What we talked about before, trivalent graphs, would be the planar algebra generated by a crossing and a vertex, modulo the same Rademeister moves as before, but also a Rademeister 4 move, which I hereby introduce, and with an additional operation, which is the unzip operation, but maybe more operations, but that's sort of the crucial one. And finally, here I did not put zero legs, so here this will be trivalent tangles. So I'm also allowing here partial pictures of trivalent, of non-trivalent graphs. And finally, the main object for today will be WTT, so W trivalent tangles. And W trivalent tangles is the planar algebra generated by the W generators, which we've demonstrated, module of the W relations, which we've mostly demonstrated, and with the unary W operations, which I just mentioned. Okay? Now, are you with me? Okay, because it's going to get harder now. So this is an instance of a generalized algebraic structure. And everything that I'm going to do from this point, or what I'm going to do in the next 5-10 minutes, works for a completely general sense of an algebraic structure. It doesn't have to come from topology. So what's an algebraic structure? An algebraic structure is a bunch of spaces with a bunch of maps in between them. So some of them would be unary, so an operation from one type of object into another type of object. Some of them might be binary, like this Psi2, which takes objects of type 1 and objects of type 2 and produces objects of type 3. And some of them might even be so-called nullary, so an operation that has no inputs but produces an output. In other words, it's a constant, so maybe there is a constant called sigma inside O2. So that's in general, this is the most general, or not the most general, but that's a very general notion of an algebraic structure. Now, I will always assume that you allow yourself to take formal linear combinations of objects, provided they belong to the same kind. Okay, so I can take formal linear combinations of objects of type 4, but I cannot take a linear combination of a cow and an elephant. Okay? And then I also assume that all operations are linear if they're unary, or multilinear, or bilinear if they're binary, or multilinear if they're multinary. Okay? So, in fact, this is an instance of an algebraic structure. The operations are the planar algebra operations, which are vaguely putting things side by side and gluing their ends. Again, it can be made completely formal, but I'm not doing it right now. And also the unary operations. Okay? But I'm, as I said, I'm allowing now formal linear combinations. So instead of just talking about knotted surfaces, I will allow myself formal linear combinations of knotted surfaces. Anyway, given any filtered algebraic structure, there is a notion of an expansion, a notion of a homomorphic expansion for it. So first of all, what's a filtered algebraic structure? It's an algebraic structure, so K, along with operations acting on it. So this sort of symbols, notation for all operations. So operations acting on it. And K is also called K0, but it has a substructure, meaning a subset of each of the types, which is closed under the operations, in the obvious sense. So it also has a substructure K1, which is, invariant under all operations, which in itself has a substructure K2, which in itself has a substructure K3, and so on. So this is a filtered structure. It's sort of a nested collection of algebraic structures, which goes smaller and smaller. Now, whenever you have a filtered object, there is something called the associated graded. The associated graded is, you take K0 and you mod it out by K1. And then you take K1 and then you add to it K1 modded out by K2. And you add to it K2 modded out by K3, and so on. Now, by sort of dimension count, informal dimension count, this gadget should be, I should have said that this associated graded is called GER of K, And the operations on K induce operations on GERK. So you have similar operations on GERK. Now, by dimension count, they should be of more or less the same dimension, right? Because you see, what did I do here? I modded out by K1, but then I added K1. I modded out by K2, and then I added K2. So sort of by telescopic summation, everything here cancels except for K0, so they should be of the same size. Okay? So an expansion is somehow something that demonstrates the fact that they are the same, that they are the same size.
This question is not algebraic, I think. Because K may not be who said it again.
Sorry, so I should have said that. When I said filtration, I didn't really mean just a sub-object, but I meant an ideal. Yeah. It's not a two-sided ideal, it's an any-sided ideal, because it's a generalized algebraic structure. So, but these things should be ideals.
And the operations should be compatible with filtration.
Yes, and the operations should be compatible. You know, it looks very remote, but in a minute you'll see that it's actually extremely common. Okay? So an expansion is simply a map from the top, so from K to GER of K, which respects the filtration, so it would map K2 to, well, to anything beyond K2 in the picture below, to the sum which starts at K2 in the picture below, and which so-called covers the identity. So, you know, people who are familiar with algebra know that this GER is a functor. So you can apply GER to Z, and then GER of Z will go from GER K to GER GER K, which is GER K, because applying GER twice is like applying it once. So the condition would be that GER Z would be the identity on GER K. Now, if this looks mysterious, here is an example. So the example would be no operations. K would simply be knots. Sorry, more precisely, linear combinations of knots. Okay? K3 would be the span of all things of the following kind. Take a knot with 3 double points and resolve all double points. So as you get an alternating sum of 8, sort of a cube with signs of 8 knots. This will be K3. It's clearly a subset of K2. K2 would be sort of sums of squares of knots, right? Alternating sums of pairs. But you know, a cube is made of two squares, a top layer and a bottom layer. So K3 is a subset of K2, and so on. Now, what is K2 modulo K3. So I claim that this is precisely what we called chord diagrams before. The claim is not obvious, but let me show you the obvious part of it. So let me show you the map from chord diagrams to K2. So this is a two chord diagram, so I have to go to K2 mod K3. So I have to find a two singular knot. Take a two singular knot whose pattern of singularities is this. And you can always find one. So, but I am not capable of drawing one. That's a different story. Yeah, I am capable. Okay? Now, so this is a chord diagram. So it's an element of the degree 2 piece of A. And I've just told you how to map it into K2 modulo K3. So this represents an element in K3, and you could say in K2, and you could say to yourself, well, what if I had chosen a different representative? Well, it turns out that all other representatives are equivalent to this one, modulo K3. Okay? So this is the easy part of the statement. But the statement still holds. And in fact, everything that we said translates to the fact that In the case of standard knot theory, Gr of K is simply A. So in the case of standard knot theory, Gr of K is what we've called A. So an expansion, in the case of standard knot theory, is a map from knots into A, which has some property. If you read back what we did in the last few lectures, this is precisely what we called an expansion before. It's the exact same thing. Okay, so I'm not doing anything new. Now, if you have an operations, then a homomorphic expansion is an expansion that also respects all those extra operations. Now, expansions always exist by dimension count. Homomorphic expansions may or may not exist. Okay. Oh, this is a just for fun thing. Do I have time for that? So it's, I'll do it very quickly. This is sort of an alternative way of viewing what an expansion is. Okay? Sort of, it's not really related to what I'm doing. So let K be the set of black and white two-dimension projections of reality. And I chose a random one as a sample. So what I really mean is take the points of R2 and allow yourself form a linear combinations of points of R2 with different levels of shining. Different points have different brightness level. Okay? So, you know, you can by mistake, you can think that these are pictures. Okay? Now, filter it in the following way. So let K1 be... K1 is you just declare that all... Oh, I think I have a shift of indices. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry, this should be 0. Okay? So K0 is just everything. So all points are declared the same, so points look like they are gray. So pictures look like they're gray. Okay? K2, you will sort of declare that points in this quadrant, all points in this quadrant are equivalent, all points in this quadrant are equivalent, and so on. Okay? And K3, you divide everything into sort of 16 pieces and declare that the points in a single piece are all the same. So there is a projection from K, so these K's form a filtration, and there is a projection from K to those quotients, okay? And these projections are the projections in which you sort of take the picture and see less and less of it. Sorry, more and more of it. You sort of pixelize it less and less, okay? Now, if you think about it, K3, so what's an expansion? I claim that an expansion is like a progressive scan algorithm. So, you know, if you, in the old times where you used to connect to the internet via a modem and everything was very slow, pictures would appear first like as a single color, then there will be a second iteration in which it will appear sharper and sharper and sharper. Okay? But really, you want to transmit in every stage only what you haven't transmitted in the previous stage. So what you want to transmit in stage 3 is the stuff that would have lost, sorry, in stage 4, is the stuff that would have been lost in stage 3. So you want to transmit the kernel of K modulo K4 into K modulo K3. That kernel is K3 mod K4. So a progressive scan algorithm would be a map from the set of all pictures to this associated graded, which would tell you how to transmit a picture iteratively. Okay? It's obvious that the choice of a progressive scan algorithm is not unique and not all are the same. So you see, so suppose I transmitted the overall gray level, then I don't need to transmit all 4 bits of information for the next one. It's enough that I transmit 3 of them. But I have to choose which 3. Okay? Now, I may have additional operations. So I may have operations like cropping a picture or rotating a picture or adjoining 2 pictures. And I may want my progressive scan algorithm to be compatible with that. And it's not obvious that you can do it. Okay? So if you have to choose 3 of the things, it's not obvious that you can do it in a way which would be rotation invariant. I don't think you can. So anyway, sorry, that was just sort of an... So in some sense, sort of an expansion allows you to progressively see more and more and more of knot theory, or of the picture you're looking at. Sorry, maybe I wasted too much time over that. Anyway, the next statement is that filtered algebraic structures, there are lots of them. So basically, take any algebraic structure, allow for a linear combination, this I already allowed, and then let K1 be the so-called augmentation ideal. So form a linear combinations in which the sum of coefficients is equal to 0. Okay? Or alternatively, it's the ideal generated by differences of elements. In fact, that's exactly what I did in knot theory. Okay? And then let Km be the mth power of K1. The mth power of an ideal still makes sense even in a general algebraic structure. So the mth power of an ideal would be the set of all outputs of all iterations of operations that you could perform, such that at least m of the inputs would be in K1. Okay? And in fact, if you do it for the planar algebra of knots, you get precisely the standard finite type theory of knots. So what I'm proposing now is to do it for the planar algebra of W trivalent tangles. I think I want to skip the easy example, which is braids, and sort of quickly say that just like in the case of knots, in the case of W knots, there will be K, which is topology, A will be diagrams in 1 minute, this is the girl of K. There will be low algebra, a mapping to the universal enveloping algebra of some kind. And then there will be high algebra, and high algebra will be this issue about convolutions on Lie groups and Lie algebras. Okay. Anyway, here's the first of the 6 statements. So the non-theoretic statements says that there is a homomorphic expansion for W trivalent tangles. In particular, Z should be defined on the generators. So there should be a value. I should be able to give you a value for this generator, for that generator, and for the trivalent vertex, and also for the less interesting generators. Now, as it turns out, this one is the empty value. So if you're forced to give it sort of a non-interesting value. This one turns out to have a canonical choice for the value. I'll write it later. And this one is the hard one. Okay? But anyway, these values should respect all the relations. Rademeister 1, 2, 3, and virtual Rademeister 1, 2, 3, 4, and all of that. It turns out that of all of these relations, only 3 cause any difficulty. All the others are easy. So, and these 3 are the Rademeister 4 move displayed here, and 2 that are displayed in green, and therefore I will not talk about them. Okay? Okay. Well, the next thing to do is to figure out the target space of Z. Right? I mean, I want elements, I want values for this, but first of all, I need to know what the target space is. So, just like in the case of ordinary knot theory, I should be looking at m-dimensional cubes of objects, modulo m plus first dimensional cubes of objects. So the fact that you mod out by m plus one dimensional cubes means that you just have to forget topology and consider only the combinatorics of the sort of double points. The double points now are double points in which you can flip an overcrossing to be a no-crossing, or an undercrossing to be a no-crossing. So there are actually two types of double crossings. And then there is, if before the double points represented over minus under, and there was no really distinction between the lower strand and the upper strand, here there is a distinction between the upper strand and the lower strand. So the corresponding curve diagrams should be really arrow diagrams. Okay? And other than that, it's essentially the same. So the space A corresponding to this skeleton would be the space of arrow diagrams with some number of arrows drawn on the same skeleton. Now, there will be also relations which come from sort of a different kind of lassoing procedures. Okay? I'm not showing them, in the next slide I am. So there is a 4T relation in which everything is oriented. And then the most fun relation is the tails commute relation. So the tails of arrows commute, but their heads do not. And this is the distinction between overcrossings commute and undercrossings commute. It becomes tails commute, but not heads. And then finally, just like in the knot theory case, you can replace the A with arrows by an A with arrows and trivalent vertices. And the trivalent vertices all have to be of the kind where you have two in and one out arrow coming out of each vertex. And then you can write a second set of relations for the vertices. So there is an STU relation which looks like a Lie bracket, and a different kind of STU relation if the orientations are different. And then there are also green relations which I don't care about. And I should say that everything is graded, and this is the formula for the degree. And then the diagrammatic statement becomes the statement that, well, as I said before, the value of the crossing, which I will call R, is in fact easy to deter, to fix once and for all. So you fix it to be the exponential of a single arrow. The exponential of a single arrow just means you take the skeleton and you put on it a number of arrows with a coefficient 1 over the number of error factorials, and then you sum over that number going from 0 to infinity. Okay? So this is what R will have to be. And then the claim is that there exists something that I don't care about, and a value for the vertex, so that if you put the value of the vertex and on top of it the value for the crossing, then it's the same as twice the value for the crossing followed by the value for the vertex, and this is just the value master formula. And then also the relation that I don't want to talk about. Okay. Just like before, there is low algebra. So from diagrams, you can go into algebras. So start from a Lie algebra, G, any Lie algebra, sorry, any finite dimensional Lie algebra. This time it doesn't have to be metrized. No need for a bilinear non-degenerate symmetric form. So let G have basis xi, and let phi j be the dual basis, and let bi j k be the structure constants. So I can turn elements of A into elements of the universal enveloping algebra. I'll tell you in a second of what. By the following procedure. So if you have an arrow diagram, you just put this, you label it with English letters, sorry, Spanish. You put the bracket at every vertex, And then you just read the word that you see at the bottom, where you read tails as elements of the dual and heads as element of the algebra. So here I read phi I, phi j, xn, xm, phi n, phi l. Okay? And that becomes a single word coming with coefficients which are summed over. And this is a word in the universal enveloping algebra of G direct sum, G dual, except it's not direct sum, because I wanted to respect the relations that were written above. So it turns out to be the semi-direct product of G with G dual, where G dual is taken with a commutative structure, G is taken with its initial structure, and the bracket of something with G and G dual is simply the standard way by which G acts on H, on G dual via the quadjoint representation. So this is the so-called inhomogeneous version of the Lie algebra. So if the Lie algebra was SO3, then ISO3 would be, instead of just rotations, it would be rotations and translations. Okay? Okay. So now in this language, yes, thank you. In this language, so with IG being the semi-direct product of G dual and G, and with R being, well, in fact, here it's written in the algebraic language, but it's really the image of the thing I drew here, the statement is that there exists something I don't care about, or not in the first pass, but also an element V in the universal enveloping algebra of IG, tensor squared, such that, and this is now a Lie algebraic formula happening in some tensor product of universal enveloping algebras. Okay? But this formula is exactly the formula that was written before, translated to Lie algebra. So V times a single R massaged in a certain way is equal to 2 R's multiplied by a V, but the R's are massaged now in a different way. But it's really the exact same formula. Likewise for the missing equations. Okay. So the next thing is to interpret the universal enveloping algebra of G as a space of differential operators acting on functions on G. So it's actually very easy. So in fact, think SO3. No, don't think SO3. Let me just say it. Okay? So an element of G dual is a function on G. So it just becomes a multiplication operator. Okay? An element of G is a so-called tangential derivation. So an element of G rotates space, so it acts on functions by derivation in the direction of the rotation. And you can check that these operators, their commutation relations, are exactly the commutation relations of IG. Okay? So, statements that I wrote before, so the statement written here becomes a statement about the existence of differential operators, of certain differential operators. And very roughly, or what this statement says is that there exists a differential operator V, but since V belongs to U of G tensor itself, it's it should be acting on functions of 2 variables on the Lie algebra. And you see, whenever you have a differential operator acting on functions, you can extend it to functions with values in an arbitrary vector space. So extend V to act on functions with values in U of G, and then the equation written here becomes the equation that V acting on the function e to the x plus y is equal to e to the x times e to the y times v. Okay? Where e to the x is a function from the Lie algebra to the universal enveloping algebra, which maps an element x to e to the x. Okay? Sorry, I said acting, I meant commutation relation. Multiplication by this function followed by v is v followed by multiplication by these functions. By these functions, yes. Okay, and then the remaining conditions, which I'll do in minus 5 seconds, is become unitarity of v, and, well, some other thing. Now here's the point. The statement that an operator is unitary can be rewritten as an equality of integrals. Because really, you know, what does it mean that an operator is unitary? It means that inner product psi is equal to psi, phi, inner product v psi. Okay, and the inner product would be just integration. I mean, the standard L2 inner product. So it's an equality of integrals. So the statement becomes some two integrals are equal. And again, since I have minus a minute, I will just tell you that when you sort of translate it a little bit further and all the dust settles, the equality of integrals becomes this equality of integrals, which says that if you have a conjugation invariant function on a Lie algebra, and the conjugation invariant, so it automatically induces, sorry, a pair of such functions, f and g, then it automatically induces a corresponding function on the Lie group by simply composing with the exponential map, then the statement would be that their convolution on the Lie algebra level is equal to their convolution with respect to the Haar measure on the Lie group level. And this is a highly non-obvious statement. If only because it's not true as stated, but only when you add some various strange prefactors, and because the convolutions on the group are generally non-commutative, but on the algebra they are obviously commutative, and maybe I should put a final disclaimer. The disclaimer I said right at the start. I do everything at the Taylor expansion level. So this equality is really on some formal level, and if you want to make it into a genuine equality of convolutions, you have to start throwing in conditions, convergence conditions, which I didn't even start stating. What I didn't talk about is how this is related to honest knot theory, and it is. I didn't tell you how to relate it with ordinary knots, what I talked about before, and this is sort of the stuff that relates convolutions, if you wish, with associators. I didn't tell you about the column about V knots. I didn't tell you about the quantum field theory that may or may not lurk behind today's story, and I didn't tell you about how hyperbolic geometry was used thousands of times in all of my talks.
Thank you very much.
But we end with propaganda. Okay. Sorry, I've ended.
Okay, thank you very much.
I mean, you do see it in the story, but not in the first pass. It has to do with the other generators. Yes. And that's the V version, in some sense. The V story, the middle column in my three column picture, in some sense. And this is the less developed, the least developed column. So I'm saying yes, and it's a tentative yes, okay? So there is something called the Epping of Kashdan quantization of Levi algebras. And that's sort of the, it's a sort of the Lie counterpart of a Hopf algebra is a Levi algebra. Okay, or the Lie counterpart of a Bi algebra is a Levi algebra. A Levi algebra is not a Lie algebra. It's a Lie algebra with some more stuff on it. Okay? So if you restrict your attention to co-commutative Levi algebras, then in fact the diagrams I was talking about, then in fact I of G, which I talked about here, is an instance of a co-commutative Levi algebra. Okay? And then there is an Epping of Kashdan statement about quantization of Levi algebras. And if you restrict it to the co-commutative case, it becomes precisely the story I've told today. Okay? But the Epping of Kashdan continues, the Epping of Kashdan story continues only also in the non-co-commutative case, and that would be the V column. I am saying it, well, you know, the evidence I think is overwhelming, but there are also gaps in this story. So.
The talk you give to the list of book, a reference, or articles, many articles?
That's always a painful question because I told Matthias already, my mouth is bigger than my brain. I mean, I tend to speak before I write. So there is a paper in the process of being written, but it's been in that on my website, and you can see where it is now. But it's been in this process, in this status for a while, and it might take another while until it's all written up.
Colorful, inspiring lectures. Thank you very much.